This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining me. In 2016, a Seattle man named Stephen Long sued the city of Seattle after parking enforcement towed his truck. Long had been living in that truck. He'd been parking it in an empty lot owned by the city. He was violating the Seattle law that says you have to move your vehicle every 3 days. Stephen Long has won his lawsuit so far. A King County judge ruled that since his truck is his home, impounding it violates the state's Homestead Act. The city of Seattle is appealing the judge's ruling, and City Councilmember Mike O'Brien joins us now. Welcome, Councilmember.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Why does Seattle make people move their car every 3 days?
Well, it's a way we manage on-street parking. It's generally set up so that people don't use the street for permanent storage of their vehicles.
Why not?
Well, if everyone decided they wanted to park all their vehicles on the street, I guess it's a policy around making sure that there's some turnover on the street so people have access to come and go. It's a law that's been in place for quite a while.
Is it a way to keep people from living in their vehicles in part?
The law was created long before I was on the council, so I don't know the specific intent, but my understanding is that it's more about making sure that the on-street parking rotates. But what it's come to represent for a lot of folks is a tool to prevent people from living in their vehicles, from staying in one space for too long. And I think it's a one of these unfortunate situations where it's kind of been reverse engineered to try to address a problem, not very well, not so successfully, but it's the one of the few tools that are out there to address this challenge, and it's complicated. And I think this ruling demonstrates that the city has, frankly, dropped the ball on coming up with proactive solutions to people that are living in vehicles.
If this man, Stephen Long, were to win again on appeal and the city could not impound a vehicle that someone lives in, what would be the worst thing about that?
You know, when I read through the judge's ruling, it's more nuanced than that.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, the approach that this judge took in the ruling is one that I agree with. You know, she is very clear in the ruling that everything she says doesn't mean the city cannot enforce its parking rules. She doesn't say that she's prohibiting the city from ticketing or towing or fining people, even if they live in their vehicles. But she is trying to balance the city's ability to enforce those laws with the reality on the case-by-case basis of individuals who are using them as their home.
Well, your city attorney is saying, assistant city attorney said, well, under this ruling, we can't enforce our parking laws. We don't know who's living in a vehicle and who's not. Are you signed on to this appeal of the ruling by the city? You supporting that?
I do not sign on to that. The city attorney has sole authority and discretion for representing the city in legal matters. I have had a discussion with the city attorney. I'm not a legal expert, so I don't want to question some of the legality of this. There may be kind of strategic reasons why the city attorney would want to appeal to preserve good case law for future instances.
Right.
But I've been very clear with the city attorney that I think the city should actually have policies in place that acknowledge that people living in their vehicles have certain rights that to their home, and we need to honor that.
What policy would that be?
You know, we drafted legislation last year that talked about this, and so there's a number of ways to do it. But, you know, when you read the judge's ruling, it's very clear for her that once the city became aware that Stephen Long was living in this vehicle, that her attitude shifted. And so I think for the city, first of all, to have a program that goes out and tries to identify people that are living in their vehicles. And so talk to folks. Is this your home? And when someone identifies, yes, this is my home, we should have the types of services and outreach to work with those individuals to get them back into housing.
So maybe they could get their vehicle back if they sign something saying they have no other address?
Well, we shouldn't impound this in the first place if we know that someone's living in it.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to do And I think in general, this is what people across the city want to do too, is let's solve the problem. I mean, we got to step back for 1 second, Bill, and just acknowledge that in a city as wealthy as Seattle, that we have thousands of people living in vehicles and in tents is a complete failure of our society, and it's unacceptable. We need to figure out how to provide actual housing for everyone in our community, and we're working on that. We have some ideas on how we might be able to do that, but the reality today is that there are thousands of people outdoors, and tomorrow I'm not going to have all the housing I need. And so we do have to have some interim measures.
We're talking with Seattle City Council Member Mike O'Brien. Short of housing for all, what's the alternative for people who do live in their vehicles? Where can they park?
Well, the embarrassing part for me is that as a city, we have no plan. And we need to come up with a plan. Now, as a city council member, I have worked with people living in their vehicles almost since I started on city council 6 or 7 years ago. And starting with the Road to Housing program, where we're working with churches to provide safe lots. But, you know, where we fund, you know, over 1,000 shelter beds in the city on any given night, we have no investments for people, directly investments for people that are living in their vehicles. And I think we need to come up with a plan.
Why don't we? You championed safe lots. They turned out to be far more expensive than thought, right?
Well, we've done a couple things. So the first program I worked with was working with churches and giving them the support so that they could host lots. I encouraged the last mayor to come up with a strategy, and they worked on the safe lots. The strategy they chose to implement was, a lot with 24-hour paid staffing on site, and that's a very expensive model. We look at our sanctioned tent encampments. Those are self-managed tent encampments. So we provide some support and services, but we also expect them to set up structures where they kind of self-regulate and self-police. It's a much more affordable model. So there are other models. In the church lots, we don't have 24-hour staffing. People living in vehicles are not terribly different than people living in the houses, other than that their circumstances are challenging. They're not, they want to live in an organized structure. They want to have some network and safety around them. You know, you put half a dozen people living in vehicles in a church lot, and they figure out how to look out for each other. And they, if the church says, hey, you need to put your garbage here, here's where you use the bathroom, we expect you to turn the lights off at a certain time, they're perfectly capable of following rules when it's clear what they can do. What I think the city needs to do...
Well, you've certainly heard the people coming to you with photos of needles, and I've seen videos of, vehicles on fire for whatever reason, whatever happened in there. I mean, you're saying that that's an overblown image people have?
There are, just like there are people that are housed that are playing by the rules and people that are breaking rules, certainly within the unhoused population, there's a whole range of folks. And I certainly see those examples. And it's important that the city is able to enforce laws to protect all of us, including people that are homeless, from folks that are not playing by the rules. But the vast majority of people that are living outdoors, they're in some form of crisis, whether it's just out of poverty or some health condition or behavioral health, mental health, addiction. There's a whole host of reasons why someone may have lost their housing today. They're still capable of being part of our society, and we need to provide some support for that.
What do you make of the argument that more so-called safe lots would attract so many more car campers to Seattle that the city couldn't keep up with the demand for parking space?
I reject that argument. I mean, if you follow that argument to its logical conclusion, then you pretty much start saying, why don't we figure out how we can provide no services at all and force people to go to another city, and it's a race to the bottom. So we can't do that. Does that mean that we shouldn't set expectations for people throughout the region to also address this problem? That's exactly what we should be doing. And, we are doing that work around all the regional tables we all sit at. And, it's not easy work to do. But people throughout the region are stepping up. They're building more services, more shelter options, more affordable housing options. So this is not just a Seattle problem. This is not... sometimes it gets characterized as like, oh, what a life, if I could live for free in a beat up old RV, why do I even bother to pay my property taxes? These folks living in these vehicles, they're struggling. This is not an ideal living situation for them either. They're not choosing to do this as a lifestyle choice, but they have plenty of money to go afford housing if they just so chose. And so when you meet with the individuals and try to address the challenges they're facing, and some of the challenges are kind of Herculean. You know, when someone is living in their vehicle and they're addicted to heroin, that's not an easy path to get them back. But that's an addiction problem. That's a public health issue. That's a behavioral health issue that we need to address as a medical condition, not as someone just making bad decisions, and get them the resources to get back.
We're talking with Seattle City Councilmember Mike O'Brien, and the city is expected to appeal that King County Superior Court judge's ruling on whether the city can impound and hold someone's vehicle against large fees if that person is living in that vehicle. That's our time for now, Councilmember O'Brien. Really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. You might have the impression that school shootings are an epidemic on the rise. NPR's Martin Costi has some actual facts for you. Stay tuned. The sound of Roosevelt High School students in Seattle yesterday walking out of class, part of a national school walkout to call for stricter gun laws. Students observed 17 minutes of silence. 17 being the number of students killed at that Florida high school last month. NPR's Martin Costi looked into the numbers around school shootings and how they are shaping our gun debate. Martin, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Emotions run high after a high-profile shooting like the one at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High. Those are emotions. What are the actual numbers regarding school shootings? What did they tell us?
Yeah, and well, I wasn't trying to challenge those emotions. They're justified and raw and real. There's nothing worse, frankly, I'm a parent, than the idea of a school shooting. There was also, though, embedded in the response to that shooting a sense that school shootings are on the rise in this country, or an epidemic. I think on the front page of Seattle Times today, we saw someone carrying a sign about how parents should feel safe sending their kids to school. And the truth is, schools are not more dangerous than they were 20 years ago. In fact, school shootings, they're a very small number of incidents to begin with, so statistically it's very tiny numbers, but the number of incidents is down, the number of children being shot in schools is down, mass shootings in general are up, but not school shootings, and that matters because there's a distinction there.
Why do some of us feel like there are more school shootings than maybe there are?
Well, I think the most common theory is that we just pay a lot more attention because of the 24-hour news cycle, because of social media, because now we have children filming these horrible situations from inside. We have clips from cell phone videos circulating nonstop on cable or on our social media feed. So the intensity is greater. Garen Wintemute, who runs the gun violence research program at the University of California, Davis, he told me about how there's a sense when there's a mass shooting in general, but especially a school shooting, no one can exempt themselves from that scenario. No one can say, well, that won't happen to me because blank. It'll happen to you if you have kids. In your mind. You know, it's like terrorism, and that sort of sense of vulnerability amplifies the sense of frequency.
Well, I don't want to be scared when I send my kids to school. I don't want them to be scared. I have talked with them about how rare this kind of thing is. Besides that, why does it matter if we exaggerate the number of school shootings?
Well, it matters because it affects the policy choices we make. If we decide this is a school shooting problem, that school shootings are epidemic, then our policies, our responses will be confined to schools, and we'll turn schools maybe into fortresses. We'll put metal detectors in. We'll run our kids through active shooter scenarios all the time. No adult wants to work in a workplace like that, but we're putting our kids through that more and more. But if we decide that this is not a school shooting problem, it's a shooting problem in general, well, then the prescriptions are very different. Then we're talking about gun availability, or we're talking about mental health, or we're talking about things that don't narrow it down to schools as though they're somehow more dangerous than the rest of society, when actually they're far, far, far safer than the rest of society, for kids especially.
Maybe one of those students who walked out of school yesterday would say, you're telling me it's not a rising epidemic. I'm saying one school shooting is too many.
Well, in fact, I talked to one of the students who protested yesterday up at Marysville, Pilchuck, where they had a school shooting 3.5 years ago, a bad one, one that's scarred and traumatized that place ever since. She's a senior now. She was a freshman then. Her name is Olivia Cerdinio, and she said she was done being sad, and now she's mad. But she also said that she doesn't see this as a school thing anymore, that it's not that schools are unsafe. She thinks this is a gun problem in general, and after she graduates from that school, she's going to continue to push that broader subject. And for her, it isn't about school shootings, it's about shootings.
How is Marysville Pilchuck dealing today with its own school shooting?
Well, they're wrestling, like all schools, with the question of how far to go with security before it becomes too much. Obviously, for them, it's a more immediate and raw thing. But at the same time, they really haven't gone overboard. You go to that school, the old cafeteria is still there where the incident happened. It's locked up. 4 people in the district have the key. Mm. They have a new sunlit cafeteria that the kids use instead. They call it the Commons. But they haven't turned the place into an armed camp. I mean, there's a new camera. There's a guard at the kind of entrance area. But they have a California-style campus, they call it. You know, and if they had the money, they weren't able to get the money from voters. But if they had the money, they'd probably remodel it to make it a little more restricted entry. But at the same time, they're not going to put metal detectors everywhere. There's a sense there that this is still a public place. And, you know, they emphasize more training, preparing teachers especially, and not turning the place into an armed camp.
Well, this is a conversation I can pass on to my kids. They might not believe me when I reassure them, but hey, I talked to this NPR reporter who backs me up.
Yeah, tell them the cold statisticians will reassure them that going to school is a far safer place for them to be than anywhere else they go, probably.
NPR correspondent Martin Costi, great to see you. Thank you for this.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. After Donald Trump was heard bragging about sexual assault on top of all of his other insults against women, did he deserve to be president? You might say no, and yet many of us do excuse the behavior of our favorite artists. Woody Allen, R. Kelly, Sherman Alexie. You can't have it both ways, says the blogger and co-host of the podcast, Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory, Katie Anthony. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write that we need to stop thinking of art as transcendent and think of it as a product being sold to us.
That's absolutely right. You know, I think art, because it is so intimate and because it does really inform our personalities and the way that we relate to others, we like to kind of put it in a special category when it comes to our consumption. But at the end of the day, the art that we choose to consume is a product, and the artists that we choose to support are, you know, essentially one-person companies. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, do I support the business practices of this company that I'm supporting by purchasing their product, sharing their product, recommending their product, clicking on it? You know, all of these acts are basically ways that we buy in to the artist as a seller of product. And it's interesting that we have kind of done the mental gymnastics to make this make this choice harder than it needs to be, I think.
What do you mean we've made it harder than it needs to be?
Well, because art is personal. You know, for example, I don't buy Hershey's chocolate because Hershey's still sources the vast majority of its cocoa from West Africa, and West African cocoa farms typically use child slave labor. So for me, it's a very easy choice to say, hey, Hershey's, I don't support child slave labor. I'm not going to buy your product. In 2018, it doesn't feel like an egregious ask, to say to a company, you know, you need to factor into your bottom line paying your labor. That doesn't feel like a huge ask to me. And as a consumer, I'm not going to support you until you factor that into your bottom line and you behave ethically. And as an artist,
the literature is giving is something, obviously, as you know, different from a Hershey's Kiss. You're giving up a lot. I mean, you're a fan of the literature of Seattle writer Sherman Alexie.
I'm a huge fan of Sherman Alexie. And it is difficult for me to say, as a consumer of Sherman Alexie's work and as a fan of his, I can't consume it anymore. I can't use this product anymore. And the way that I'm kind of thinking about it is this. Stay with me. It's a little bit of a metaphor.
I'm listening.
So imagine you're shopping for a dining room table. You're looking for the perfect table and you finally find it. And it's just the most beautiful piece of furniture you've ever seen. You love it. You can't wait to put it in your house. And as you look a little bit more closely at the table, you realize that one of the legs of the table is made of ivory. And now it's not an antique. This is a new table. And you have to make the choice. Am I going to buy this table? Knowing what you know about the ivory trade, knowing what you know about what had to happen for this ivory to appear on this table, are you going to buy the table? And for me, that is the way that I think about Sherman Alexie. If we think about his careers being based on, you know, four legs, for example, one of those legs is talent. One of those legs is hard work. One of those legs is emotional availability and willingness to be vulnerable. And one of those legs, as we now know, is the habitual abuse of power and sexual harassment of people who would have thought of him as a mentor and someone who could help them in their careers. And I can't look past that ivory leg myself on that table. I can't buy that table anymore.
Do you also think that not reading a Sherman Alexie book would change something outside of your mind, but besides aligning with your values, what do you think it would change?
Absolutely. So this is the second part of this conversation that gets a little bit trickier. I feel much better about myself as a consumer not buying Hershey's chocolate, not buying Sherman Alexie books, not sharing links and all of that anymore. But does any of that, you know, do those actions translate to meaningful change on a bigger scope? On the one hand, yes, because Sherman Alexie is a contemporary artist who relies on fans and consumers of his work to continue to be successful. Until he changes his business practices, if people stop supporting him, he's going to be forced into a position where he needs to make changes and choices as a professional.
So this is not about sending a message to the world. Sherman Alexie's no longer a bestseller. You're saying you would be changing Sherman Alexie's personal behavior if he's not selling tons of books?
I mean, here's the thing. There's nuance in this conversation. There is not nuance in dollars. So if you're not supporting the artist's work, knowing that that artist wasn't unable to factor into his bottom line as a producer of product to be respectful of other human beings. I'm totally okay with that consequence for him. Now, that is as a consumer. I am also a member of society. I am also a person who's contributing to a dialogue around this. And I can't just walk away from the table, feel good about me, and say, I solved the ivory trade, right? That's not how it works. So as a consumer, I'm not going to support the product anymore. As a person, I have to engage with this problem, because it's the only way it gets solved.
Katie, I'm talking with Katie Anthony here, a local blogger, writer, podcast host. There's a native author, Marionette Pember, who said, I wonder if we removed all the books and art created by men who've also done despicable things in their lives, our shelves and walls would be mighty empty.
Yeah, they absolutely would. And that speaks to a couple of problems. Number one, whose voices we think of as valuable. And I think that's a very serious problem, you know, and particularly with someone like Sherman Alexie, who is, again, very talented and has worked very hard and has also kind of become this monolith in terms of this is the native voice in our contemporary American literature. This is the big one. And we as a culture have to start asking ourselves, what stories do we deserve to be told? Do we think deserve to be told? And what stories do we think deserve to be retold? What stories are we willing to show up for again and again and again? Because if you think about, you know, the traditional narrative of like the guy who lost his wife and now has to, you know, fight his way out of a tight spot, you know, that's The Fugitive, that's Gladiator, that's Braveheart, that's Finding Nemo. That story people think deserve to be told over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so why are we, you know, narrowing down the native voices in this country who have valuable stories to tell to just this one guy? It's incredibly unfair.
What if Sherman, and of course Sherman is an example and we're talking about something bigger, but what if Sherman writes next about sexual harassment, even not on the nose, but let's say it's obliquely, artistically, in literature? Would you want to consume that? Would you still want to read his stories?
Well, I think if we're not willing to grow as a culture, then what are we doing here having this conversation? So absolutely. And I really love the segment that you did earlier this week with the two Native artists who had this conversation that was so so incredibly insightful, and something that they said really resonated with me, which was that they don't want to cast him out. They want to bring him back in, and they want to help him heal his heart. And I think that's the next stage of this conversation. For me, the first step is making these people uncomfortable enough with their choices that they understand that they need to change. And that's not buying the table. That's not buying the book, saying, I don't support your business practice of abusing your power, sexually harassing people, and silencing the voices of younger artists who would look to you as a hero. I don't support that. Stage two is the rehabilitation and the eventually the healing. And that is a long process and a complex process. And
how would you picture that healing happening?
Well, for Sherman Alexie, I am absolutely going to shine the light on the two women who spoke on this program earlier, because there is...
By the way, maybe we should tweet that out, a link, if our listeners want to hear that. We talked to Sarah Marie Ortiz, an Acoma Pueblo writer. We talked to filmmaker Tracy Rector, member of the Choctaw Nation and head of Longhouse Media.
Exactly. This is a messy process, and particularly when we're in an age where intersectionality is a word that more and more of us are familiar with and comfortable using. You know, Sherman Alexie's identity as a Native is incredibly important in terms of how this issue gets resolved for him. And as a reader, as a potential future consumer of his work, I would absolutely trust his own community to resolve this with him in a way that feels just to them.
One of the things I loved about that conversation is that the word love came into it. You know, these writers and people who know Sherman, they have a lot. They have love. They have frustration. They have a sense of justice. There's a lot there. And Katie Anthony, is this hard for you?
It's incredibly, incredibly hard. It is. There are so many hard things about it that it's hard. They're racing through my mind right now. It is hard to be disappointed by someone that you've admired, because art is a conversation between the artist and the audience, the listener, the viewer, the reader. There is an intimacy that happens there with artists that you love, that you know, they help you to see yourself more clearly. And when that person is revealed as someone who's done something that's very hurtful to you, it feels very personal and it's painful.
But why end that conversation that you're talking about? You close that valuable writer out, and are we still having a conversation? Are we listening?
Absolutely, because I'm not supporting him as a consumer anymore, but I am absolutely willing to engage in the conversation around how he can heal himself and how his community can work in this way to engage in their own processes that you know are certainly not my expertise or my wheelhouse.
What about Sherman Alexie library book that he does? It's not a paid read.
Well, I mean that's the thing. That's everyone's choice. I personally am not going to go see the new Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find the movie because I'm done with Johnny Depp. He's ruined for me personally. And you know, I know the author Claire Dieterer wrote in the Paris Review recently.
Seattle author, yeah.
Yeah, she wrote about how you know she's able to watch some Woody Allen movies and enjoy them. And Annie Hall for her is intact as an experience, but Manhattan, kind of icky, she said. And so,
how did you feel about that?
Well, I would not presume to tell any other person about how to have a relationship with their art. I would just, you know, tell anyone who's struggling with this question that you don't need to be afraid of putting your money where your values are. You don't need to be afraid of saying, I don't agree with this and I'm not going to support it anymore. And that there is a distinction between saying, I'm not going to support your art anymore and saying, I'm done with you as a human being. Those are two different things. Now, for most of us, like, I don't know Sherman Alexie personally. I am not, you know, unless I write him a letter, which I certainly could do, you know, my ability to engage with him on this is extremely limited. So as a consumer, I can either buy his books or not. I'm choosing not to. If you choose to do that, that's absolutely fine. On a recent podcast episode, my podcast co-host and I read a comment from one of our listeners. And Ronit, my podcast co-host, said that it was such a brilliant idea. He said if he has to engage in a piece of art that is somehow problematic, that he will engage in it. He'll see the movie. He'll buy the book. He'll read it. And then he will make a greater donation to an organization that is combating that whatever problematic stance was present in the art.
Yeah, that work. Does that work for you?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's kind of like punching someone in the eye and then giving them a foot massage. Like, you should have just not punched him in the eye, you know? That's just me personally. But again, I'm not going to presume to tell anyone else how to interact with their art. Just go into it with open eyes and don't be afraid to say no.
Final question, Katie Anthony. In your blog post about this, Sherman Alexie and the million-dollar question, you say we don't extend the same courtesy to women that we do to men, that if a powerful man behaves badly, we say no one's perfect. If a woman alleges harassment, you say we expect them to be the perfect victim. Is Me Too changing that?
I think
Me Too movement?
I think so. I think we still have, it's still so incredibly early. And when we talk about a massive culture shift, you know, that has to start with a lot of personal accountability. And this is a time of extremes. People are taking extreme points of view. And as we're kind of moving a little bit more toward the middle again, there's this simultaneous fear that we're losing ground. But also this is a natural evolution of this process, that we're going to find more nuance. We're going to find more complexity and contradiction in this process as we move through it. I'm hopeful that, you know, women are not going to have to be perfect victims anymore in order to be heard. You know, every story that comes out is incredibly painful, but the pain was already there. Now we just know about it. And I think that's progress.
That's blogger and podcaster Katie Anthony. The blog is called Katie, Katie, Kate. Her podcast is Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. And she says that as arts consumers, we need to examine our own role in allowing abusive men to behave with impunity. And by the way, your co-host on the podcast, Ronit Plank,
yes,
who you mentioned. Always good to see you again. Thanks for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be back in a moment. The Oscars of the food world announced their nominees yesterday. The James Beard Awards will announce the winners in May. Seattle's June Baby got a nomination for Best New Restaurant. Never eaten at June Baby? Well, KUOW's Ruby DeLuna visited last year and talked with chef, owner, and potential winner of this year's Food Oscars, Eduardo Jordan.
Just let the guests know that this is hot. I think the sizzle might inform them.
It's about half an hour before June Baby in Seattle's Ravenna neighborhood opens for dinner. Chef Eduardo Jordan goes over some of the new items on the menu with his staff. One of them is red rice served in a hot cast iron pan.
So it's going to be like a blistering hot cast iron, kind of trying to get like that paella, kind of crispy bottom feel. We're adding like a little bit of Benton's ham stock, which is a smoked ham from Tennessee. Finishing it with some crispy plantain chips.
Jordan has been getting local and national praise. June Baby is his second restaurant. His first one, Salare, also in Ravenna, tells the story of how he came to be a chef.
It's a taste of my culinary journey. We use Northwest ingredients, and it's my take on those ingredients done from a French standpoint, Italian standpoint, and my Southern background.
Jordan was born and raised in Florida, where his early food influences were his grandmother and mother. He didn't set out to become a chef. He majored in sports management and business administration. But after an internship with the Tampa Devil Rays, he decided that wasn't the career for him. It was food that excited him, and he wanted to share that passion.
My grandmother always had open doors, and she fed anyone that was hungry. We had like little pop-up dinners that she made a little bit of money for the churches. She basically sold dinners from my house. And that was our form of entertainment, our form of hospitality, and I saw it and I experienced it. I was part of it.
He tried to get a job in restaurants, but was told he didn't have the technical skills. So he went to culinary school. He then realized he wanted to explore other foods outside of Florida. So began Jordan's culinary journey. It took him to California. With some persistence, he got an internship at the French Laundry, the altar of fine dining. It was followed by Seattle, New York, and Europe. He returned to Seattle because he was drawn to the seasons, the region's proximity to the sea, and its emphasis on sustainability. A year and a half after he launched Salare, he opened June Baby. Here, he wanted to feature foods from his youth, like his grandmother's fried chicken, chitlins, and her pound cake.
This is like my grandmother's expression. If my grandmother was cooking back there with me, this is what the food would still look like.
Well, almost. There might be some Northwestern touches, like adding foraged mushrooms, but Jordan says he doesn't stray far from tradition. In the process, he realized that when it comes to fine dining, the food he grew up with was missing. To change that, he figured he'd have to do that himself. Leslie Coaston and her sister Lori Menzel had similar thoughts when they opened Kingfish Cafe on Capitol Hill in 1997. They remember people had concerns that Seattle didn't have a big enough Black community to support their restaurant. But the sisters had other ideas.
We're not looking to just draw from a community. You know, we wanted to introduce it to other communities. And then people were like, well, how's that going to happen? Yeah. And
it's just good food.
Kingfish Cafe closed in 2015. Rents were rising. Their father was very sick and needed help. It was a tough decision. Menzel and Coaston say they're excited to see chefs like Eduardo Jordan putting Southern food on the map and getting recognition. African Americans, they add, have been cooking fine dining food for a long time, but someone else often gets the credit.
If you look at a lot of the early American, you know, films where they're doing stuff on, you know, plantation owners or the presidents or, you know, whatever, when they're served and the people in the kitchen and the people, you know, creating all of this food for these, you know, spectacular events, it was us, you know.
And
so
it was fine dining.
And it was fine.
Yummy dining. Yeah.
Order for a biscuit, broccoli. Second course, rice and a turkey leg.
Rice. Biscuit.
Back at June Baby, dinner service is underway. Reflecting on his culinary path, Eduardo Jordan says opening June Baby second has allowed him to break stereotypes.
If I would have opened up a June Baby or a June Baby concept first, it would have been pretty easy for people to stereotype like my food right away and my talent as a chef where, oh yeah, the Black chef opened up a Southern or Black food restaurant.
Jordan says he's glad it didn't work out that way.
I think like the path that I was on helped me to express myself as a culinarian first rather than a Black chef first, which I'm fine with either way.
Jordan says his culinary journey isn't over yet. His cooking is informed by Seattle and its transformation while still keeping true to his roots. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
The New Mariner ads are out. They're kind of tepid, but my favorite has the catcher holding the ball inside a picture frame as other players come to admire the art.
Strike three!
Wow. It's beautiful.
The way he paints the corners.
Amazing.
I mean, it makes you lean in, then it slaps you in the face.
That's right. Well, as a hitter, I find that offensive.
I think it's stunning. Look at that guy.
Now the hitter's looking stunned, and then the pitcher takes the ball.
I'll paint a new one.
Mariners baseball, true to the blue.
Felix Hernandez can always paint a new one. And if you're a Mariners fan, you're going to be enjoying those ads for the next half a year or so. A little spring training update here from Peoria. You can add Ichiro to the list of banged up Mariners. Ichiro was driven off in a golf cart last night after hurting his right calf. So that makes first baseman Ryan Healy, second baseman Robinson Cano, shortstop Gene Segura, starting pitcher Felix Hernandez, left fielder Ben Gamel, and designated hitter Nelson Cruz all recuperating in the desert sun. Predicted highs in the 80s next week in Peoria. And the Mariners open the season Thursday, March 29th at home against the Cleveland Indians. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Now, for our next segment, we are going back, way back. Recognize The Cure?
I do recognize The Cure.
Back to your high school computer class now, if you're of a certain age. It's the 1980s, Walkmans in backpacks and satin jackets and lockers, Apple IIe computers running BASIC. And where is this nostalgic wonderland, you ask? That's reporter Kurt Schlosser of GeekWire here to share. Hey, Kurt.
Hi, Bill.
Where'd you find this time machine?
This time machine is right here in Seattle. It's in SoDo. At Paul Allen's Ode to the Living Computers Museum and Labs.
people might not know Paul Allen has this computers from back in the day museum.
Yeah, this is a fun interactive space, and this exhibit is the latest sort of thing to drive people down there. I went down and I was transported back to my childhood.
What was take us inside? So what, you come in and what's the first scene you see?
Well, you come in on the first floor and you know, you see some modern technology, you see their normal exhibits, and then off in this corner, they've constructed three rooms. One of them is a high school classroom, and you enter school as you would as a teenager into this math computing class. And there's a bunch of very nice vintage desks, orange chairs, and a bunch of Apple IIe computers. There's an overhead projector up front, which we all remember. Remember the teacher having trouble deciding which way was up or down?
With the transparency? Turning it the other way? Yes.
And that sets the scene. There's a linoleum floor that they put down, a drop ceiling. There's pencils stuck in the ceiling.
They don't do that anymore? Maybe that was an 80s thing. Yeah.
I think we do that at GeekWire.
John Hughes. Okay, good.
But that's... So the objective at Living Computers is that you can use any of these machines. So you take a seat at a desk and start messing around with BASIC. And the class will be led by...
BASIC was this early language,
yes.
Computer language.
Yeah, I think the 2E came out in like 83.
Yeah. And you didn't have Windows, so you were programming in this language.
So you're in class. There's some lockers in the classroom. If each locker that you open sort of reveals a different story about a different type of kid, stickers, pictures, the jackets that are hanging in there are all period. There's a backpack hanging on a chair. That Cure music that you played is actually on a mixtape inside a Sony Walkman, which we all remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you're sort of following the story of this fictional teenager named Alex and her typical day. She leaves school and she goes to work at what's called the Bit Zone, which is a video arcade right next door to the class. You walk in, dimly lit.
Those places were loud. I hope Alex is holding up okay. It'd be a headache.
And I hope it will be loud when they get a bunch of visitors in there, because there's seven games, you know, some classics. Donkey Kong, Centipede, Asteroids, Tempest,
Joust. I'd forgotten about Joust.
Joust. I was never a Joust player. Uh-huh. I immediately went to Centipede and Donkey Kong when I walked in, because they have a free token machine. So this is like
sweet.
You could spend the day there, make back your price of admission, and play as many games as you want.
Is the idea that you just hang out and bask in nostalgia, or what's the museum going for? What's in it for them?
It's very much an interactive and an immersive experience. They enjoy folks taking part and putting their hands on the machines. Your memories are triggered by using these devices. All the video games are restored to working order and are in great shape. And they want to see how people mingle with all of this stuff. There's no introduction to the exhibit. There's no artifact labels on stuff. It just is there in the corner of the museum, and you become part of it.
So you were a Centipedes guy?
Yeah, and maybe not so much this week when I played. I did pretty well. I looked at the high score and thought, I'm gonna make a run at that. And about 7 minutes later, I was done.
Uh-huh. I was into Defender. They didn't have Defender.
Defender.
Huh? Mm.
And
shame.
Were you good at it?
I was really good at the 7-Eleven. I was not so good at the mall, SeaTac Mall arcade. You know, they can tweak the game so it's easier or harder.
Yes.
And I think at the 7-Eleven, maybe because I could be buying snacks if I hung out long enough, you know, I could gather a crowd. Remember that? People would come around?
Yes, very much so. Mine was at the roller rink or at the bowling alley on Saturday mornings. You'd miss your turn. You'd be up for bowling on a five-man team, and your buddies would be yelling at you, get over here, and you had to give up your game to go back and throw a couple balls. But
harsh.
Man, yeah. Look at us reminiscing about the 80s.
The arcades were kind of a racket. I remember when they would take out the quarters or the tokens and think, wow, that's a mint. So at least you don't have to worry about that at the museum.
No, and that
mattered when we were kids, by the way. You had to budget.
That's why I played games that I knew I could get a few screens out of, because I didn't want to just pop a quarter in to learn something new and all of a sudden, you know, I was out of that money. And the money went fast. I had a paper out that paid me a little bit, but not enough to just be hardcore. That's what's cool about this exhibit, is that they had special tokens made called the Bit Zone, and you push a button and they pop right out. So I could foresee people down there for quite a while.
These kids today, you probably bought your son's Xbox, I assume? So he didn't have to budget, he didn't have to worry about his paper route budget.
No paper route. That's a good point. I should push him in that direction because every video game that he gets is a lot more expensive than the 25 cents I was popping down. Even when I was a kid, I had a ColecoVision growing up. You remember those?
Yes.
I was not a
I think I had Coleco guy. Football.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, thanks.
My son plays Xbox now, and it's quite a juxtaposition between what he's experiencing in our basement rec room as opposed to what I maybe experienced in front of my sort of old TV. It's come a long way, as we know.
And this is what I'm getting at. What about that long way? Where did we come to? What do you like? I noticed in your article at GeekWire, this is Kurt Schlosser from GeekWire. I think you quoted one of the museum curator types as saying, you know, you used to have to physically put the cartridge in. And that made me laugh because in the actual 80s, my parents would be saying, you know, you used to physically have to hit the ping pong ball over the net. So it's like everybody seems to look back and just remember whatever effort, whatever, even however small it was, we went to more effort back when we were young.
Yeah, totally. And you know, I think we're in this period now where we have a little bit of an appreciation for that analog stuff. That's why vinyl LPs have come back so strong. And, you know, some of these older games that are recreated even in apps or whatever that we play, they're touchstones. And that snap of the cartridge into the thing reminds you that there's a little bit of effort there and you're going to be rewarded for pulling that off.
Even in 20 years, they're going to say, man, I remember when you had to physically swipe your phone to find the different, to go to the next app. You didn't, now you just have to think it and it appears. Yeah. Back in 2018, we were putting effort into our smartphone use.
Well, you know, and I watched that series, Black Mirror on Netflix, and I always think that the technology just feels like we're just almost right there. And it could be as simple as close your eyes and play a video game or there's a little chip behind your temple or something.
Yep.
My kid will get that.
Yeah, lucky kid. Well, what do you think of where video games have come? Like, you could say that video games now, you know, Centipede, I guess you were shooting the Centipede, but it didn't feel like slaughter, like I think some of the first-person shooter games are. On the other hand, you have Minecraft where you build stuff. So what's your take on where we are today?
Yeah, I think, you know, the pew-pew-pew mode of video games that we grew up with is certainly long gone. Everything is so hyper-realistic now, you know, I think parents would be mindful to keep an eye on what their kids are playing, certainly with games like Grand Theft Auto, where there's language, there's sexuality, there's certainly a lot of violence, whether it's through guns or through the automobile as a violent tool. I think it's worth a conversation and separate that fantasy from reality, and hopefully, you know, that's a dialogue that's obviously going on in our country right now, but if parents are on point, then the kids should get it, at least at a certain age. And I play games with my son that range from FIFA soccer, which he kills me at, to this thing called Just Cause, where he's like a mercenary in Central America and he's got to rescue a bunch of people. I think he plays it because he gets to fly around with a jetpack and certainly blow stuff up, but I don't think he gets the violent political overtones that are maybe written into the story.
Right. Are kids having that communal experience? I know you can obviously play with people you can't see, but, you know, at the 7-Eleven, when I was on my game, it was kind of fun to be in a crowd of kids.
Yeah, I mean, on a Friday afternoon after a week of school, it certainly sounds communal in my basement when the Xbox is going and they're all yelling and screaming. And they're not out in public at an arcade doing that, but certainly those spaces are available in Seattle for kids to do that, and I think they probably are. A lot of it is VR now.
Right. Final question for GeekWire's Kurt Schlosser. What letters would you put in when you had a top score? Do you remember?
KRS.
KRS. Initials. You went straight with the initials.
Yeah.
You didn't use a num to centipede.
No.
Thanks for the nostalgia.
Sometimes it was REM.
REM. There you go. I knew there was something lurking. GeekWire's Kurt Schlosser traveled back to time to high school in the mid-80s, and you can do that too at the Living Computers Museum Plus Labs. Their new exhibit is called Totally 80s Rewind. Kurt, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for listening today. Our show is made for you by Amina Al-Sadi. She enters AAS when she gets a top score. AGB is Ajua Jimabrempong, JTP, Jason Pagano. BDR, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm B-E-R. I use my my middle name. Plus, it sounds like Burr, which is like ice cold, which I thought was cool when I was 16. And tomorrow in the Week in Review, we'll get you smart about the week's news. Students walk out. Seahawks blow up. We'll talk about those stories and more with former Attorney General Rob McKenna, King 5's Natalie Brand, Crosscut's Knute Berger. Join us tomorrow for the Week in Review.